You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, firearms and fashion might seem like two unrelated fields, but the Neville Public Museum in Green Bay says their evolutions both mark big changes in society. We'll learn all about that history in their Guns and Gowns exhibit. First, yesterday at this time, we unraveled a complicated story about absentee voters in Wisconsin receiving two ballots for the spring elections. That story unraveled a little more after the show. Wisconsin's Elections Commission decided to scrap the potentially confusing two-ballot plan for the statewide general elections, mostly. Military and overseas absentee voters will still see two ballots. Can't get around the law and the timing on that one. Everyone else, you're back to seeing a single ballot in the statewide general primary election. Now, a bill that would prevent another backlog in testing sexual assault evidence kits is on its way to the state Senate. Assembly Republicans passed the measure this week by a vote of 62 to 36. In addition to setting timelines for the processing of these evidence kits, the plan also included language relating to illegal immigration and school choice. Democrats called those last two provisions, quote, poison pills. The issue goes back to 2014, when there were about 6,000 untested sexual assault kits in the state. The backlog was eventually eliminated, but some lawmakers, as well as Attorney General Josh Call, have been saying there needs to be a law to keep it from happening again. A bipartisan bill that established testing deadlines was introduced last May and passed the Senate on a voice vote. It's been stalled in the Assembly because the chair of the Health Committee, Joe Sanfilippo, has refused to hold a public hearing on it, saying a law is unnecessary. He does support this new plan that passed the Assembly, though. David Steffen joins us now, Republican state representative from Howard, representing the state's 4th district. He's author of the sexual assault kit bill that passed the Assembly. Representative Steffen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
It's been a long road to get here. Can you talk about the need for a bill like this to try to prevent that future backlog of sexual assault kits?
Absolutely. So I was the original author of the first bill that was introduced early in the session to address this issue. And as you mentioned in your opening, we had such a substantial backlog of up to 10,000 rape kits that had not been tested. And what we identified through the process is that they were actually, there was nothing malicious about any of it. It was just being held up in hospitals and clinics and sheriff evidence lockers and not making its way to the crime lab. And so that created this enormous backlog, which denied and delayed justice for many women across the state and allowed perpetrators to still be out. And so I met first with Attorney General Brad Schimmel, and then after the election with Attorney General Josh Call to say, hey, tell me what we need to do to get this addressed. Let me be a leader on it in the legislature, and let's work together. And so that was the process. We brought together stakeholders from all different backgrounds and acumens to be involved, from sexual assault victim advocacy groups, forensic nurses, the Department of Justice, law enforcement, to make this a great bill. So that was the original bill, Assembly Bill 214, that I authored. Unfortunately, it was not making its way through the process. And so it was a situation where there were some, like, the chair of the health committee, who said, hey, I don't think we even need this. Can't the Department of Justice just handle this issue on their own? And then there were some who wanted to do some, go even further. When you're dealing with something that is so personal, so transformative and impactful as sexual assault kits, and how do we address that, and how do we protect the rights of the victims and further justice, a lot of people were interested. And it became an issue where I had to reintroduce a second bill that included all my original language, but then had to include the thoughts and interests of others within the chamber so that I could get it to the floor.
Yeah, those additions ended up having to do with an illegal immigration provision. So what does that new part of the bill do?
So, and it's so interesting, because when you put in undocumented immigrant or illegal alien in any piece of legislation, it seems to trip a wire of sorts in people's minds. But it was incredibly positive, because undocumented immigrant girls and women are top targets, top prey for predators who engage in sexual assaults. The state of Texas did a tremendous amount of research and tracking of this. And so the provision, what it does is provide the ultimate shield and sword to undocumented immigrant girls and women by having it so that if a perpetrator is also an undocumented immigrant, that he could be immediately deported back to the country. So talk about having swift justice for someone who is in that situation. And so that wasn't part of my original proposal, but the authors of the amendment came to me and said, hey, I think this is important, and this will get me to yes on your bill. And so that's how it got included.
Talking to David Steffen, Republican State Representative, looking at a sexual assault evidence kit bill that passed the Assembly this week. The other addition to the bill had to do with a voucher schools as an option for people who've been victimized. Can you talk about that?
And this provision is the one that I hope would never come to pass, the one that would never be utilized, because essentially what it does is it allows a child, okay, we're talking usually a young girl, who is raped, sexually assaulted within a school, that if the perpetrator is within the same school, so a classmate, a teacher, whatever it may be, that they would be immediately eligible for the CHOICE program. And why is that so important? Because we had legislators who came to me and said, I've had this situation in my district. And because so many of our districts, there is only one elementary school, one middle school, one high school, that the option for that girl to be in an environment where she doesn't have to physically walk past her, the offender, in hall, in gym, in the lunchroom, the only way to help remove them from that trauma situation is to provide them another schooling option. And sometimes that means that they would have to leave the city. So by having this option that allows that individual, that child, that girl, if her parents feel it's necessary, to immediately be eligible to go to a parochial school through the CHOICE program, that they would be eligible. And again, let's hope that that provision would never be used, never be necessary. But that protection, that relief valve, at least would exist in this bill.
We talked to Attorney General Josh Call about the issue last week. As you say, you worked with him at the outset for the first version of the bill. He's not a fan of the revised one. Here's a listen. We don't have that. I'll quote. He says, my concern with this new proposed legislation is that it's an effort to allow members of the state assembly to vote for legislation that appears to be doing something on the issue, when in fact this is just their way of passing something that's not going to get passed in the state Senate and signed by the governor. And that we're ultimately, Call said, not going to get something accomplished. So he's worried that you'll pass this in the assembly. There's the other version in the Senate. We're not going to end up with any sexual assault kit testing bill. What would you say to that?
Well, I tell you what, I'm worried about every piece of legislation I draft and introduce it becoming law. The process in the United States and state of Wisconsin for any piece of legislation is not easy, and that's by design. And I'm hoping that he's wrong. He doesn't have a vote on this. This is something that the legislature has to discuss and debate. And there is the legislation that I work with him in over the last year. It's entirely in this new bill. So there shouldn't be any concerns with it. The issues that, you know, just in a very modest way touch on undocumented immigrants and very modestly touch on voucher schools. My goodness, I can't believe that someone would say that we can't move forward on this because it's such a modest element that has been included. It's just the wrong message to be sending to people, and especially to the victims of sexual assault, that because there might be a handful of girls who, after being raped in school, may want to go to a parochial school after, you're going to not support the bill? So I don't get it. I think it's a wrong position. I think he's sending the wrong message. And I'm going to remain hopeful that over the next month, the Senate will take up and pass the bill.
Representative Steffen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's David Steffen, Republican State Representative from Howard. We talked with him about his bill aimed at preventing backlogs, in sexual assault kit testing. That bill passed the Assembly by a vote of 62-36 on Tuesday. We talked with Attorney General Call about sexual assault kits last Monday. Here's two things you might not think are related: firearms and fashion. Well, the Neville Public Museum in Green Bay says not so fast. They've put together an exhibit there called Guns and Gowns, 200 Years of Fashion and Firearms. Beth Lemke is executive director of the Neville Public Museum in Green Bay, and Lisa Kane is the curator of the Guns and Gowns exhibit. Beth, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
And Lisa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, Lisa, some people might not put these two things together, the firearms and the fashion. What is it that you wanted to put those together, the history of them, in the same exhibit?
Well, it actually started in 2016 as a program. We do some behind-the-scenes tour-like things, and our educator and I usually do those together, and we were kind of joking around about what would attract couples or what would attract a whole family. And it kind of started as a joke, and as we really kind of looked into it, it worked out. So we did that program, and it was a success. And then Beth looked at us and said, hey, can we make this an exhibit?
And Beth, what do we see when we walk through the Guns and Gowns exhibit? Give us a little picture.
I think the Neville team did a great job of blending the fashion pieces as well as the firearms. It is a mixture. It does have a chronology to it. So we look at the earliest pieces from the Revolutionary War, but we bring it all the way up to the Vietnam era. And so you're looking at the conflicts as well as then bridging the technology and the fashion at the time. And it's a really neat presentation of signature pieces from the Neville's collection.
And Lisa, before we dig into each of them on their own terms, doing this together, did you see some kind of common theme emerging as to how guns and gowns changed over 200 years?
Oh, yes. It happened a lot around conflict, and that kind of became a theme that, like Beth had said, you know, drove a lot of the story, not in every era, but if conflict wasn't the driving force, it definitely was technological change. But actually, those two things crossed a lot, you know, over the last 200 years.
Now, let's start with the dresses side of thing. I just picked at random between the two. As you're looking at the exhibit they put together, Beth, what jumps out at you when you look at the evolution of the dresses over that time period?
Oh, I think of the women who wore them. We look at the team made custom mannequins for each gown because there's not one standard way. And as the time changed, the gowns changed. But the women's shape also defined the dresses. So there are Dutch court gowns that had huge bustles and would have needed corsets to things then in the 1970s where you have more of a slim, you know, hanging dress. And it's just a wide array of color and texture. And, yeah, I just think of the women.
And, Lisa, I looked at I haven't been to the exhibit in person, but you've got a lot of the pieces online. And something that struck me was that a lot of the things on both sides, the guns and the gowns, they have a Green Bay area connection. Can you talk about how the pieces fit in locally?
Yeah, and that kind of speaks to what our collection holds. It's a lot of Eastern Wisconsin people's stories, so the women's stories or even the veterans who carried the weapons. And it kind of worked out that way. We talk a little bit about those Green Bay connections. One of them is the Dutch court gowns that Beth was talking about. It belonged to the Tonk family. So in our area, a lot of things are named after that early Green Bay family. And it's actually the woman who came here, she came here and brought these gowns with her. They were her mother's, and she wore them at court in Holland at the time. So they all have this kind of connection. We got a lot of Civil War connected stories. And then through the years, you kind of see these connections to veterans really emerge after World War I, which was kind of fascinating in our research.
And Beth, looking at the gowns over the era, did that give you a feel for, as part of what a museum does, what it was like to live in these different time periods?
Absolutely. I think in each vignette, the staff did an amazing job of taking background textures and images to help supplement what was going on during the time period, whether it's a black and white photograph from Pearl Harbor when we're looking at World War II, or where we have amazing photographs from the collection. So in one of the sections, there are, you know, an array of women in photographs behind the Civil War gowns. So you kind of see that context, and it's just a really neat display.
Talking to Beth Lemke and Lisa Kane with the Neville Public Museum in Green Bay, talking about an exhibit there now, Guns and Gowns, 200 Years of Fashion and Firearms. Let's turn to the firearm side of things. Beth, can you talk us through the range? Talk about changes in technology. There's been a lot over the last couple hundred years.
Definitely. That's where I think our team excels at, because I'm not definitely the expert in that, but we definitely go from the Revolutionary War and flintlock all the way up to automated types of weaponry in the exhibit. my favorite piece, because it has such a cool story to it, is there is a Tommy gun. And the interesting part about it, it's on loan from the Green Bay Police Department. The Wisconsin Bankers Association purchased it and gifted it to the police department because they were concerned about bank robberies. And the Green Bay Police Department didn't have a weapon like that in its arsenal. And so that's one of the two borrowed pieces. The rest are from the Neville's collection that are stored on site. But that one just has such a powerful piece and a powerful story.
And Beth, can you talk about the role of firearms in the history and establishment of Green Bay?
Ooh, that I was going to say. That would be more of a Lisa question.
Oh, it's Lisa. Sorry.
That's what I was going to say. She's got definitely the history down pat for that one.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really interesting because the guns, like Beth said, are a part of our collection. And most of what is ours does come from these veteran stories. So they're either having these weapons they were using for hunting and taking them to war with them, or some of them are actually were gifted to us in a big collection. So it was a gun collector, and so he had a wide variety of guns, everything from the Revolutionary gun to a pen gun, you know, from the 70s. So the range is just, it's quite amazing, and you can see a lot of history and a lot of technology just within that space.
And Beth, part of what I love about museums is, you know, you're seeing the thing, the stuff, but also then the people who know things connect it with the story of the place or the time or the person. Can you talk about how this exhibit fits into telling the story of Green Bay?
I always challenge the team to say, what is it that we have in collection storage and how can we make it relevant and how can we bring it out in a way that it's displayed in a beautiful style, but makes you want to walk up to it and learn more about it. And so in this case, the exhibit does just that in the pairing of both the technology and the firearms and the fashion, where it's the entire story is there. And you can just look at one time period or you could look at multiple time periods. But what we're seeing is we're seeing families coming in. We're seeing couples come in, even multi-couples like that have been on like multi-double dates, like coming in and just looking at the exhibit. And you can see how they gravitate. Sometimes, you know, they're going into one section or the other. But at least for some people, they're coming in because, you know, like they fought in an encounter or they were part of a combat. And they're like, I remember this and I wanted to see it again.
Lisa, was it a challenge in some cases to find guns and gowns that fit in together in the same time period?
A little bit. It was we have a lot. The fashion was pretty easy, actually. We have over 250 dresses in our collection and countless other skirts and, you know, all of that. The guns, to match them up, that's why we had to borrow. So we borrowed the Tommy gun because we didn't really have anything from that time period, and that story just fit in perfectly. We also don't really have anything post-World War II. And it kind of, there's a lot of reasons for it. You know, veterans not holding on to their, you know, soldiers coming home don't hold on to their weapons. And there was some changes in military regulations. So we didn't have anything from the Vietnam era either. And so we actually borrowed the weapon that's on display there from the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. And where we really have the most is Civil War carbines and muskets, and then World War II. We are a little light on the World War I as well, but luckily we had a few pieces, including the machine gun that is on display to kind of fill in some of those gaps.
Beth, you mentioned the couples and groups coming in to see things. This seems like it would be a really fun conversation starter to look at how these things have changed over time in parallel. Are you seeing people react in that way?
Absolutely. The exhibit's on our first floor, so whenever I get a chance to going through the museum, I just kind of stop and watch and observe. And it is very interesting to see how the conversations are happening. That makes the exhibit a success in my mind, because we want to see conversations. We want to see talking. We want to see that interaction in the gallery. And the exhibit is doing that, and we just hope that everybody gets a chance to come and see it.
Lisa, you mentioned a couple of the stories, the bankers buying the police a Tommy gun, the gowns that were worn at the Dutch royal court. Were you able to find a lot of personal stories attached to these artifacts?
Oh, yeah. Actually, my favorite is probably the Pearl Harbor one. The dress that is in our collection, it's a short, purple, very 50s, 40s, 50s style dress. But it was her wedding dress, and she wore it, and we have it in our collection, and it said married. It was December 20th or 22nd or something of the year, Pearl Harbor. And as I dug into it, I searched her name, and it came up that her husband was at Pearl Harbor and was the photographer that has the photos at the Wisconsin State Historical Society. So he was there. He took photos of the event and then comes home, and 2 weeks later they get married, probably because he's going off into the conflict. And so it's just interesting how that one event that he photographed, well, that's a great story. The dress kind of combines it, and then you get a whole picture of this couple who had to go through this thing based on a conflict that we kind of see as history in the past, but it was very much there.
Yeah, that's fascinating, Beth. And yeah, this we read about the history of something in a textbook. It's pretty interesting to see it taking place in, you know, people lived in the neighborhoods people in Green Bay live in now.
Absolutely. And it's that just the connections, and then being able to say, you know, whether you like the fashion style or didn't like the fashion style, or, you know, my mom wouldn't let me wear that because, you know, that was too short at the time, or I really wanted that. Or in some cases, there's a maternity gown, which totally took me by surprise in the collection when they said we had one, because you can just think how it had to be adjusted over time, and maybe some of the hardships that came with that, but also the positives that came with it. And some of the gowns we know were kind of retooled based, again, if they were passed down. One of the gowns has additions onto it, so the base of it's older than some of the pieces that came on afterwards. But, you know, again, economy and being able to embellish and adore and turn something old into something a little bit newer or fashionable.
Sounds great. Beth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
And Lisa, thanks for being with us.
Oh, yes.
That's Beth Lemke, Executive Director of the Neville Public Museum in Green Bay, and Lisa Kane, Curator of the Guns and Gowns exhibit we've been talking about. It runs through January of next year. They join us in our studio in Green Bay. Democrats are calling foul on the Trump administration for its actions in the lead-up to Roger Stone's sentencing. Stone is a close friend and longtime associate of President Trump. He was found guilty last fall of lying to Congress and witness tampering. That was connected to his efforts in providing Trump's presidential campaign with Russian hacked emails. This week, federal prosecutors recommended he be sentenced to 7 to 9 years in prison, but their guidance was upended the next day by the Department of Justice. It said 7 years was too much and that something, quote, far less would be more appropriate. That prompted all four prosecutors to resign from the case. President Trump has denied directing the DOJ to change its recommendation, though he had tweeted about the sentence. At least one congressional Democrat, Eric Swalwell of California, told CNN that if Trump got involved, he could be impeached again.
You know, we're not going to take our options off the table. We don't wake up in the morning wanting to impeach him. You know, we want to work with him on prescription drugs, background checks, and infrastructure. But we're not going to let him just, you know, torch this democracy because he thinks that he's been let off once and we're not going to do something about it.
And in the news this afternoon, in an interview with ABC News, Attorney General William Barr said Trump never asked him to do anything in a criminal case, but that, quote, his tweets make it impossible for me to do my job, end quote. He said it's time for Trump to stop doing that. Barbara McQuaid is a law professor at the University of Michigan and former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Barbara, good to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Let's look at this Department of Justice intervention itself here, changing the prosecutor's suggested sentence here. Is this something that happens very often?
No, it almost never happens. I'm not ever aware of it happening before. In a case like this, it would be routine, I would think, for the prosecutors to alert the U.S. attorney within their own office and for the U.S. attorney to make sure that the attorney general is briefed on what the position of the government will be. It's a high-profile case, and the lesson was always the attorney general never wants to read about the position the department is taking in the newspaper. If it's a high-profile case, you alert him in advance as to what's happening. And so to see the pleading get filed on Monday and then a very different pleading get filed on Tuesday asking for a lower sentence, both under the name of the same U.S. attorney, is really unusual. And it says to me something happened in between. And the only thing that's really publicly known is that President Trump tweeted in between his great displeasure at the position taken on Monday. And that kind of involvement is deeply disturbing.
How much importance is there in this request, suggestion from prosecutors as to the sentence of someone who's been convicted? Ultimately, the judge still gets to decide, right?
Yes. So this is just a recommendation. The judge is the decision maker. But she usually wants to hear from both parties. Tell me what I should be thinking about as I fashion a sentence. Government, you tell me what are some of the facts of the case, any aggravating factors, what's your position? Defense, what else should I keep in mind here? What mitigating factors might I consider? And then come up with a decision. What's important to know about the position of the government, though, is that the position they took is the guideline sentence. That is, there is a set of U.S. sentencing guidelines that list out what a presumptive sentence ought to be in every case based on the offense and based on specific offense characteristics. You add that all up, look at a grid, and that's where they got the 7 to 9 years. That is a very typical starting point. And so to suggest that that is oppressive or unwarranted under the circumstances is just not true. In fact, there are aggravating factors here that could have merited arguing for a higher sentence, but certainly nothing I see that would support a lower sentence. And so the position that was the second position of the Department of Justice is really a very lenient one.
President Trump was asked earlier this week if he instructed the Department of Justice to change their recommendation. Here's some of what he had to say.
No, I didn't speak to the judge. I'd be able to do it if I wanted. I have the absolute right to do it. I stay out of things to a degree that people wouldn't believe, but I didn't speak to him. I thought the recommendation was ridiculous. I thought the whole prosecution was ridiculous. And I look at others that haven't been prosecuted, or I don't know where it is now. But when you see that, I thought it was an insult to our country.
Attorney General Barr also today said the president didn't directly tell him to change this this sentencing recommendation. If the president had done that, I mean, is there anything illegal with it? Question one, anything wrong with it, even if it's not illegal? Sorry about the two-part question.
Yeah, no, that's okay. It would be permissible, legally permissible, for the attorney general or even the president to suggest what a sentence ought to be. He is the head of the executive branch, and so it is within his legal right to do that. But I think since the Watergate scandal, we have seen presidents steer clear of what happens at the Department of Justice. We want to know that cases are brought based on facts and evidence and law and not on partisan politics. The idea that a president could be targeting his enemies or helping his friends is antithetical to our system of government. And so we've seen the Justice Department maintain independence, put norms into place to do that. For example, every attorney general has issued guidance about restrictions on communication between the Department of Justice and the White House to keep politics out of those kinds of decisions. And so to see a president intrude on that is really not only harming the independence of the Justice Department, but the perception of the independence of the Justice Department, which I think will make it in the long term ineffective. There are also ethical problems with a prosecutor making decisions based on personal opinions of the individuals under investigation. Ethics rules require prosecutors to make decisions based on facts and evidence and not based on any kind of personal opinion about the target.
Talking to Barbara McQuaid, law professor at the University of Michigan, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, looking at the Roger Stone case, the changes in recommendations of sentencing that came from the Department of Justice. Now, the president had tweeted his unhappiness with these recommendations from the prosecutors before then the Department of Justice moved in and lowered that request. The president said he didn't talk to the attorney general directly, but if the president is publicly tweeting his opinion on this, does that amount to a recommendation anyway?
Yeah, I think that this idea that the president didn't speak directly to the attorney general about it doesn't deserve a whole lot of merit. The president makes his opinions known when he tweets about it and tweeting in with exclamation points that this is a miscarriage of justice. I think he can be sure that that's going to get back to the attorney general, that he's telling the whole world and it's going to get written about in newspapers. President Trump appears to use the kinds of tactics that we see a lot from corrupt public officials and organized crime bosses. And that is, I don't need to tell you directly what I want you to do. I make my wishes known and it is understood that you should do what you need to do to carry out those orders. And I think that President Trump operates in the same way. It gives him plausible deniability to be able to say, I never told him to do that, but he made it very clear what his wishes were. And so his minions scurried to get it done.
Well, I want to look at some of the latest news now. Now, President Trump had tweeted congratulations to Attorney General Bill Barr for taking charge of the case. And now Attorney General Barr talking to ABC, I'm going to quote somebody told him. He says, I'm not going to be bullied or influenced by anybody, whether it's Congress, newspaper, editorial board, or the president. I'm going to do what I think is right. He goes on, I cannot do my job here at the department with a constant background commentary that undercuts me. And he further said, it's time to stop the tweeting about Department of Justice criminal cases. And he said, the president's criticisms make it impossible for me to do my job. So that was, I think, kind of surprising statements from the attorney general there today. What do you make of that?
It is. It's a good first step in that direction. I think what it suggests is that President Trump is not directing the orders. He is saying things that are distracting and make it appear that he is directing the orders. I'd rather see a more specific statement from the Attorney General where he comes out and says, we do not take directive on our cases from the President of the United States. In this case, this decision was mine or whoever's it was. It's based on the facts and the law. This, I have found that it's really interesting to read statements from William Barr because you can learn as much from what he doesn't say as from what he does say. He doesn't say that we changed our mind after we saw President Trump's tweet on Twitter about this. He kind of dodges this case altogether and just says that President Trump's tweets make my job harder. I bet they do, because President Trump, after the fact, congratulated William Barr on reversing the sentencing recommendation. And so that was the part of it that made William Barr look very bad. And so I'm sure he would like President Trump to stop. But I'd like to know a little more from William Barr. I think we'll hear from him the next time he is scheduled to testify before Congress. But I think someone who is a leader and cared about the people who are working in the Department of Justice and making sure that the public sees the department as independent and free of political influence would make a stronger statement about the independence of the Department of Justice, not about his personal strength from being bullied.
Stepping away from the personalities involved here, do we have a structural problem? Sometimes the executive branch is going to need to be investigated, and the investigating body is controlled by the executive branch of the U.S. government. Do we need more structural ways to separate out that control over the Department of Justice?
I think what we really need is a Congress that takes its job of oversight and impeachment more seriously. We do have an executive branch to investigate crimes, but when it comes down to the president himself or even cabinet officials like an attorney general, the remedy for misconduct is impeachment. But we have seen now that President Trump is emboldened by the inability of Congress to execute its own powers of impeachment and oversight. And so I think what we're seeing is the lesson that he has learned is that he can act with impunity. I think that if we had a stronger Congress that was putting its loyalty to country or even its loyalty to its own branch ahead of its loyalty to the Republican Party, then we might see the kind of oversight that we need. So I think that's what's breaking down, and that's why it seems that there's no check on either William Barr or President Trump.
We're talking about the controversy surrounding the upcoming sentencing of Trump confidant Roger Stone. Barbara McQuaid is our guest, law professor at the University of Michigan and former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. You can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Justice Department intervening, overriding their prosecutor's sentencing recommendation? Those prosecutors resigned from the case. What do you want lawmakers to ask Attorney General William Barr when he testifies as scheduled next month? Do you have questions about how all of this works? Should President Trump pardon Roger Stone? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the upcoming sentencing of Roger Stone. Federal prosecutors initially sought a 7 to 9 year prison sentence. Then the Justice Department came out, overruled that, said it was too harsh. That ultimately prompted all four prosecutors in the case to resign. Barbara McQuaid is with us, law professor at the University of Michigan. You can join at 800-642-1234 with your reactions and your questions. 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Barbara, that question I threw to listeners a few moments ago about the idea of pardoning Roger Stone, the president's gave a non-answer to that. He said he hadn't made a decision or was considering whether he was going to pardon Stone. But people have raised the question, if he was going to pardon Stone, why push for a lighter sentence? What are you watching for on the possible pardon here?
Yeah, I think what often happens with pardons is that those are decisions made especially in the controversial cases, in a president's second term, so that those decisions can't be used against him in a re-election campaign. So I would imagine he would like to see a lenient sentence for Roger Stone so that perhaps even a sentence of probation so he doesn't have to serve any time in prison. But if he does, I would expect sometime after the election, if President Trump is reelected, to see that if he is not reelected, I would expect to see a pardon sometime in that lame duck period before the new president is inaugurated.
Let's go to our callers now. Marvin is with us in Fish Creek. Marvin, hi.
Hi. Hey, you were talking before about the impartiality of our Justice Department and Bill Barr being part of that. And I think that ship has sailed. I think Bill Barr kind of, he played that card when he smoothed out the Mueller report for President Trump. And it seems to me that's too late. What Bill Barr did recently by reducing the sentencing on Roger Stone is just another, he's just showing his hand again. And that's where I am.
Marvin, thanks for the call. Marvin referring to Attorney General Barr's summary of the Mueller report before the whole deal came out. What do you think, Barbara?
I can't disagree with what Marvin has to say there. When William Barr rolled out the Mueller report, you may recall the chronology. Robert Mueller submitted his report to William Barr as the Attorney General, along with an executive summary. And Robert Mueller intended for that summary to be the public's first impression of what it said. Instead, what William Barr did is he held on to it for about 3 weeks and issued his own statement about what it said. He said that Robert Mueller found no collusion. He also said that Robert Mueller was unable to find or decide whether there was obstruction of justice. And so William Barr himself decided that there was not. As a result of that, President Trump was able to say repeatedly and loudly, no collusion, no obstruction. Now, of course, that is not what Robert Mueller's report actually said. It did talk about coordination of messaging. It talked about welcoming help from Russia. And it talked about at least 10 instances of obstruction of justice. And so I think that William Barr was very savvy about how he did that, because by the time that report became public 3 weeks later, the public had made up its mind and moved on. And so I do tend to agree with him that it's hard to overlook that very political move and give William Barr the benefit of any doubt now when he's talking about how, you know, he's independent and won't be bullied.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to John now in Stevens Point. John, hello.
I think we only know the tip of the iceberg about everything that's going on. And I think that it would be nice if Trump would quit tweeting and pay more attention to business, because he does use the tweeting to use as his chronic advertising tool. I mean, obviously, he's learned from his previous careers how to do that. The same token, whatever the government says, I question everything that comes out of the federal government right now.
John, I just want to clarify, do you mean currently under the current administration or going back before the current administration as well?
Oh, yeah, the Clintons come out of office bankrupt, and within 5 years, see, I have two children I have to answer to each day, and I tell them, how can they become worth $700 or $800 million in 5 years after? It wasn't from selling books, of course.
John, thanks for the call. So, John, and I think a lot of people skeptical about certain parts of federal law enforcement, even in the pre-Trump era. Barbara, what would you say to them?
Well, I think that it's always healthy to make sure that law enforcement is being scrutinized, are being transparent, and are being held accountable. Certainly, as far back as Watergate, and maybe even beyond that, we've had abuses by the FBI and CIA with unauthorized spying programs and those kinds of things. And that's why we demand oversight. We allow Congress to peek behind the curtain and see what's going on to make sure things are being done properly. It's why we have whistleblower protection laws to provide a proper channel for government employees to report fraud, waste, and abuse in a way that they can't be retaliated against. And so all of those things are really important to proper functioning of government. And so, it's the attacks on those things that I think can cause us problems, because we've got humans who are running all of these federal agencies and law enforcement. And from time to time, humans make mistakes or humans do the wrong thing. And so we need to make sure that we can take a look and oversee what they're doing and making sure that they are complying with the law.
Thanks for calling in. We're talking to Barbara McQuaid from the University of Michigan Law School, looking at the Roger Stone sentencing, the Department of Justice overruling initial sentencing recommendations from federal prosecutors who then resigned from the case. Back to your calls now. Joe is with us in Milwaukee. Joe, hi.
Hi there. My thoughts are, first of all, that Roger Stone absolutely deserves 7 to 9 years. He, is guilty of the things that he's charged with, and he was disrespectful to the judicial system, to the court. And I also think that Bill Barr proved last time that he was attorney general that he's willing to lie to protect the president. I think that is part of what he believes his job is. And he's out there investigating conspiracy theories at the whim of, this president, it's clear that he's willing to do anything the president asks, regardless of its legality. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Joe, thanks for the call. Barbara, your thoughts on William Barr's longer-term career?
Well, he's famously said that he's not worried about his legacy because he'll be dead. And so he's going to do whatever it is he wants to do. I can kind of take that in two different ways. One is, I'm not going to be really worried about people second-guessing my decisions. I'm going to do what I think is right. But there's also a more sinister message there, which is, I'm going to do whatever I want, and I'm not worried about long-term legacies or history. And I think there's something that can be damaging about that, this sort of nihilistic sense of the ends can justify the means, and I can get done what I want to get done. Of course, in our country, we value process so much as the outcome and as much as the ends. Some of the things William Barr has done in prior administrations, including recommending pardons for some of those involved in the Iran-Contra scandal, also suggest this idea of, you know, unitary executive, strong executive power, and I don't really care what other people think about me. I think there's value in making sure that you are not only reaching a desirable end, but that you're doing it by proper means.
In our last minute or so, I want to go back to the prosecutors who resigned from the case. What do you make of that decision?
I'm sure it was a very painful decision for them. Three resigned from the case, and a fourth actually resigned from the Justice Department. These are amazing jobs that people work very hard to get, and I'm sure it was with great pain that he left. But I think they sent a very powerful message, and I know I'm hearing from my former colleagues around the country, you know, for, DOJ alums, who are grateful for to them for the stand that they have taking a strong stand to make sure that the public understands that this is not okay, and bringing attention to this matter in hopes of changing it.
Barbara, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Barbara McQuaid is a professor at the University of Michigan Law School and a former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She joined us today for a look at the Justice Department's intervention in sentencing recommendations for Roger Stone. Federal prosecutors had initially asked for 7 to 9 years in prison, but the Department of Justice overruled them to seek something, quote, far less. Stone is scheduled to be sentenced next Thursday. Attorney General Barr has talked about the case some today and the president's tweets. We'll keep watching that story, and you can follow it with NPR newscasts at every hour and half hour. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, online scams and bots are targeting U.S. military veterans and active duty service members as part of disinformation campaigns. We'll talk to a veteran who's devoted his career to tracking down and revealing those schemes. A lot of baby boomers are moving out of their homes and trying to get rid of excess stuff along the way. We'll talk to two experts about the best ways to downsize and the tough decisions that need to be made. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. WPR's Lori Skelton is back with us. She's been trying out lots of different cheesecakes, traditional, sweet, savory, no bake, with bacon, completely vegan, and more. It's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.